Hello and welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I am your host, as always, Ben Davison, and I am once again joined, as I will be every week, by the lovely, the fantastic theatre maker, Guardian columnist, and political mind, certainly of this area, possibly of a generation, Van Badham. Welcome, Van.
I'm still marrying you, Ben, I promise.
Threats. Very good. It's so lovely to be with you again.
And we live together. It's not like you have a choice. Like, we're both on the mortgage, Ben.
This is true. I want to just thank everybody who took the time to download and listen to the first episode of The Week on Wednesday.
Yes, we were so surprised and so relieved and so thrilled. So thank you.
Massively outperformed our very modest expectations. So thank you very much. Hopefully episode 2 will continue the run and be something that you want to download and share with your friends and family.
It's certainly a jam-packed episode. We have a special guest, Ben.
We do. We have Andrew Giles, the Shadow Minister for Cities and Urban Infrastructure, Shadow Minister for Multicultural Affairs, Shadow Minister Assisting for Immigration and Citizenship, and of course, the Federal Member for Scullin. That's one man.
Yes, one man of many, many talents, as anybody who's had the Giles experience would know. His title this week also becomes Our Man in Canberra, and he'll be giving us a rundown about what's on the parliamentary agenda after a 70-day break when Parliament in Australia is finally meeting again.
So we can look forward to that later on in the show. First up, though, let's dive straight into it before Germanicus wakes up and disturbs the recording.
Yes, the dog is on my lap, everybody, if you need a visual, nestled into my shoulder.
Liberal Party branch stacking in Victoria, Van. What's
so
going on?
It all comes out after the hand-wringing and condemnation of the Labor Party because of the activities of the Labor Party branch stacker Adam Somniarik, whose activities, nefarious activities, of trying to manipulate pre-selections and build a power base were exposed by 60 Minutes a few weeks ago, as I'm sure everybody remembers.
And he was sacked.
He was sacked.
Like next Andrews, day, gone.
Andrews famously said he will not be given the opportunity to resign. He was necked, and quite publicly. Well, the Liberals were, this is your Anthony Albanese. Is condemned, blah, 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 and on it went. Well, they've been up to exactly the same thing. And it has involved the delightful triumvirate of Marcus Bastian, Ben's favourite member of the Liberal Party, Kevin Andrews, obviously infamous anti-marriage equality crusader, and Michael Sukkar. And they're all hardcore conservative. And what they've been doing, apparently, is organising a very hardcore extremist conservative religious communities to join the Liberal Party. And the congregations haven't necessarily been told that they are becoming members of the Liberal Party to build this sort of hard right religious fundamentalist faction in Victoria.
So these are people they've gone to see who lead religious groups, maybe not who haven't told the religious groups themselves. You know, you can imagine being in one of these groups. Well, maybe not, because they're often, you know, quite anti-women, quite anti-equality, quite anti-union. So maybe we can't really imagine what it's like, but you could imagine being somebody who goes along to something every week and then suddenly is told by the leader, come up, we're all going on a field trip, and everybody gets piled into a bus and trundled off to some MP's office where they're voting in a pre-selection between candidates they've never met, never heard of, and wondering why they're in a Liberal Party office to begin with.
And the scandal, of course, is that Mr. Bastian, who's a party official, he's not a parliamentarian, but he has had a group of boyos who have been attached to this. There's always boyos in these projects who have been going around, you know, doing the legwork and signing people up. Well, the boyos have been on the payroll in Mr. Andrews's office. And apparently this has all been organised with the knowledge of Mr. Sukkar, who is the assistant treasurer of our country, and Mr. Andrews. And the revelations just keep coming. So originally Mr. Sukkar threw, of course, another staffer under a bus, saying it was, a staffer was operating without his knowledge, which is difficult to believe if you know anything about the way parliamentary offices work. And keeping secrets is not really what goes on with the staff there. But this, you know, so Sukkar was like, oh, no, it wasn't me, sir. It was, you know, this guy who doesn't even work for me anymore. Well, yesterday it came out that Mr. Sukkar has been using taxpayer money to employ a friend of his to compile what are not known as smear pamphlets, but have a word that we promised Apple we wouldn't mention on our podcast in order to attack factional rivals. And he has also, so this friend of his has been paid to do quote-unquote graphic design for his office, and he's also been responsible for various hirings and firings in Mr. Andrews's office around the morality boyos doing this certain kind of factional legwork. So I'm very curious as to why Scott Morrison hasn't nicked him with the speed and alacrity that Daniel Andrews displayed in the Adam Somniarik situation.
And, of course, the real – one of the real issues here is that Michael Sukkar is the assistant treasurer.
He's the assistant treasurer, everyone.
The assistant treasurer of the Commonwealth of Australia at a time when Australia is going through a massive economic crisis, where Australia is trying to borrow money on global money markets. It's trying to reassure the international credit rating agencies that we are a safe, stable place to lend money to, that we will repay that money.
That we are not corrupt.
That we are not corrupt. Corruption is one of the fundamental things that undermines international confidence in an economy. And this behaviour has been described by some people, including a corruption expert on 60 Minutes, as corrupt behaviour. So we're not the first ones to come out and say this is a problem, but certainly we can see this is a problem. If you're in an emerging economic crisis that may go on for some time, massive levels of unemployment, huge need to borrow on the international money markets, you don't want somebody involved in that process, at the heart of that process, literally a heartbeat away from being treasurer, who is under this cloud of corrupt behaviour. And Sukkar might go, oh, well, it's not me, sir, it's somebody else. But the reality is these offices are very small, Van, as you've pointed out. The idea that you could have somebody in your office undertaking this kind of behaviour, printing these kind of pamphlets, distributing them, bringing people in and getting them to sign large numbers of forms for other people is and not know about it is ridiculous.
Now, it's inconceivable. It's implausible. It's inconceivable.
Now, I get Kevin Andrews is, what, 1,000 years old and, you know, maybe doesn't understand how the WhatsApp machine works.
Well, given that he was spawned from a pit of tar, hate and bigotry, well, yeah, like he probably doesn't understand how humanity works. So, and I think that's been clear for some time.
So of all of them, he's the one I'm most likely to give a leave pass to because the Liberals themselves have said he's too old to have the seat. That was the big push against his pre-selection last time. So maybe he is out of touch with what's going on. But again, it looks like Sukkar and Bastion have taken advantage of that themselves to make use of his office resources.
And I think it's important that people understand, like, speaking to friends of ours who are not political wonks, who are like, oh, it's just terrible and they're all the same. Well, that kind of person is the same. And that kind of person who's obsessed with power and achieving power through, you know, through deceit and manipulation, they're common to all parties. There are people who are like this in the Labor Party. There are people who are like this in the Greens. There are people who are like this in One Nation. Like, no one is spared. That doesn't mean it reflects the behaviour of a significant number of political party members or parliamentarians. The overwhelming number of people who get involved in political parties, whether it is the Liberals or Labor, Greens, One Nation, whoever, they get involved because they have sincerely held political beliefs and want to see those beliefs represented in the political in the parliamentary system.
Absolutely.
And that's why they campaign for election. You know, even people who I would consider to be my political enemies, i.e. the Liberal Party, One Nation, and to be quite fair, the Greens, I can't but admire the noble intent of people who pursue their principles politically, of course. And there's no question that the majority of people are not corrupt and they despise corrupt behaviour. But wherever there is power, you are going to get people who pursue it opportunistically. And the only way that you can deal with that is a constant process of interrogation and really strong behavioural controls. Andrews coming out and necking Somniarik immediately was exactly what should have been done. And I want to know why Scott Morrison has not done that, given the cloud that's now hanging over the assistant treasurer as well as Kevin Andrews. They should absolutely be sacked. They should absolutely be kicked out of the party. Everybody across the country has to have confidence that political leaders are prepared to stand up against corruption. And that's what branch stacking is.
And they say, you know, the standard that you walk past is the standard that you accept. And clearly Dan Andrews was not prepared to walk past the Somniarik situation. He put his foot down and he brought an end to that to you know, over some levels of objection from individuals who were concerned about what the knock-on effects might be. But he's stayed firm and fast on that. Whereas Scott Morrison is, you know, that's an administrative issue for the Victorian branch.
That's an administrative issue. Yeah, it's a question for the Victorian bar. I reject the premise of your question, Ben. I reject the premise of your question.
Certainly is a clear demonstration of two very different types of leadership, and in fact, one I wouldn't even call leadership. So let's move on, though, because we've got a lot still to cover. Other big issue that's going on at the moment, of course, talking about the assistant treasurer, talking about the differences between the parties, is job losses. We've seen we've seen, and last week we talked a bit about privatisation. Well, Qantas this week has said 2,500 jobs will be outsourced. This is effectively sacking 2,500 people, isn't it?
This is in addition to the other 6,000 people who Qantas have already laid off. And we can see it across the economy. We saw massive job losses at Virgin. We've seen them at like financial services companies. We've seen them in retail. It's happening everywhere. And on a micro level, Ben and I were at our butcher's the other day and found out that the butcher had advertised a job vacancy for one position in the butcher shop.
Delivery driver. Part-time.
Yeah, two part-time delivery driver, 200 applications. And we know that this is happening. Like friends of ours whose parents, you know, who've held jobs their entire working lives are suddenly unemployed, negotiating Centrelink. Like it's spreading everywhere. And yet no sign of a jobs plan from the Morrison government.
No. The Morrison government plans so far seem to be to make announcements for programs that never actually distribute a dollar, whether it's the home builder. Don't forget you've got to have $150,000 in cash to begin with before you can access any help, or the program for the arts and entertainment industry.
Where not a single dollar has been handed over yet, and everybody in the arts and entertainment industry is standing in a circle. I mean, I don't know if you read the piece that appeared in The Age, Ben, about the company who are events and effects company who hosted the announcement from Morrison about all this money that was going to be released to the sector. They haven't seen a dollar. They were the hosts of the event and they have not seen a dollar.
And it's so typical of this kind of Morrison government approach at the moment, which seems to be to make a big song and dance, a big fanfare about what they're doing, not actually doing it.
Like imaginary vaccines.
And then at the same time, there's some negative stuff in there too, because as I understand it, the Morrison government has cut domestic content requirements.
Yes, they have. They've cut. In Australia, one of the ways that we sustain a local film and television industry is that we have had domestic content obligations, which have meant that if you are a broadcaster, you have to devote a certain percentage of your broadcasting to local content. This is very common internationally. Mm. Countries like France and Germany have much higher domestic content regulations than we do in Australia, but it means that there is a guaranteed space for market for Australian film and television producers to supply content. Well, the Morrison government have got rid of that. That is going to have a huge impact on studios. It's going to have a huge impact on writers, technicians, actors, you know, a lot of the talent that we deliver to the world. Like, let's look at the Hemsworths and let's look at people like Melissa George. They all came through Australian soaps, Australian content before they went on to launch successful international careers and do their country proud. Well, Morrison has literally just kicked out the ladder that allows that to happen.
And it's just so sort of cunning, isn't it? That make a big song and dance about some money that actually you don't release anyway, at the same time as very quietly through a minister, through a press release, I think it was even on a Friday afternoon.
Yeah, usually.
Making a cut, making an announcement. And this is their approach, right? The only example that I can see where they're taking a different approach to this kind of song and dance about something positive and just on the side we'll do something negative is actually with superannuation, where they've taken a very deeply ideological position. And what we've seen now is that in June, more money came out of super than went into super. $50 billion has come out. And it actually looks like Australians are using their retirement funds to get this country through the crisis.
Yes, it's Australians who are footing the bill for the Morrison government's abrogation of responsibility for maintaining the economy during this time. And it is shocking. I mean, I want to start on a micro level about superannuation, because someone like me, who has been, I've been in the job market for 30 years. And yet, Ben, to your amusement, you can tell everybody what my superannuation balance is. It is
about $20,000.
Because I have worked casually, because I've been in the arts, because I've had periods of unemployment from time to time, and because I've earned so little money in the jobs that I do, I have little accumulated superannuation. And like I said, I've been working for 30 years and across five industries: academia, retail, hospitality, hospitality, the arts and the media. Where the pay is low, the conditions are insecure and the threat of unemployment is always hanging over your head. And that makes me quite typical of the victim of the contemporary crisis in superannuation, which is, of course, women in casualised industries. And the issue is, of course, that as we head towards retirement, like I'm 45 now and retirement is not as long away as it used to be, that has really huge economic and social implications for the care of women, for the sustainability of the pension system and for, you know, quality of life and dignity for senior Australians. And I mention this in the context of looking at, you know, the fundamental thing to understand about superannuation. It's not meant to replace the pension. It's meant to complement the pension. Mm. Because what a lot of younger people don't understand is that when you leave the workforce, your ability to get a loan from a bank is near zero because you don't have an income. If you're an ordinary person and you retire, that's it. You only have the pension income. That's not enough to get a loan. So if you're like my mum, who's 78 now, and you're trying to live independently, and, you know, my mum's in good nick and doing pretty well, but the plumbing fails in her little townhouse and the plumber comes in, that's several thousand dollars. It's not what the pension pays for. The pension hasn't got space for that kind of capital, for accumulating the kind of capital that's used to be spent on home repairs and things like that. My mother has various medical issues that sometimes require her to meet a gap, like and these kind of things are what superannuation is for, so that you have a buffer and you have some comfort and you have access to capital in your retirement, so you're not an older person whose health and strength is failing, who's surrounded by a house you can't maintain that's falling down around your head, who has medical problems that could probably be ameliorated, but we don't have the medical system anymore that pays for universally everything, and, you know, the various other things that come up. And that's the terrifying threat about what's going on with Scott Morrison making Australians pay for the pandemic themselves out of their retirement balances is a time bomb that is going to affect an entire generation of people when they retire. And if you spend the amount now, I can't remember the 20,000, if you spend that now, that will cost you $100,000 in terms of your retirement.
Because for many
of the
way, people, yes.
Where that the situation works. That's $100,000 you will not have to repair your house, fix your car, like spend on your health, spend on nutrition or any other kind of support that you need. Mm. And that's genuinely terrifying.
It is a very short-sighted approach, isn't it, to say, oh, well, we're going to let people delve into their retirement savings now for what is a short-term economic crisis. And it's really setting up a long-term economic crisis into the future. And the reality of this is the Liberals have always hated superannuation.
They have. I mean, just before I get you to talk about, to give us a big picture, we know in this country, and there's been a lot of media over the past couple of years, that the fastest growing number of homeless people in Australia is older women, like senior Australian women who have retired with no money, who find themselves homeless in later in life. Mm. And we know that that is a massive and growing social crisis. And yet the Morrison government have set up a situation to ensure that that actually gets worse.
Yeah. And it's this kind of lie that's being told now by the Morrison government, members of the Morrison government, who are saying, oh, well, people should take the money out and rebalance their own balance sheets, in inverted commas, and use it to buy a house. You know, we shouldn't have a government that says to people, you can either own a home or retire. We should have a government that's saying to people, we will help facilitate you having a home, having a place to live, and facilitate you being able to retire not in poverty. Australia has the third highest level of poverty in retirement in the OECD, the third. That's why we created super. Now, we still have that high number because the system hasn't matured, because those kind of systems where you get people to start saving when they start work take a lifetime. They take a lifetime, and we haven't quite had an entire working lifetime yet. So we should be looking at how we improve that system. How do we make it better for women? Because it's still not quite working for women. How do we take away the minimum thresholds that mean people like yourself, Van, if you're not earning $450 a month with one employer, that employer doesn't have to pay you super. And that's how we have in a gig economy as well, lots of people who are perhaps earning more than that a month, but not with one employer and therefore not getting the payment. How do we take some of the profiteers and sharks from the banks out of this process? Because the money shouldn't be going to shareholders in foreign countries. It shouldn't be paying dividends on your super. your super should be paying back into your super. They're sorts of reforms we should be looking at. How do we improve the system? But the Morrison government is taking to this thing with an axe and isn't improving the system at all. It's basically getting people to take all their money out of it. And you can understand why. I can totally understand why. You lose your job, you're worried about your home, you're worried about your bills, you're worried that you may never actually have disposable income again. Suddenly somebody says, hey, sign this form, we'll give you 10 grand, no questions asked. And then in a few weeks, if you sign it again, we'll give you another 10 grand, no questions asked. That's appealing to people. In this circumstances, that's appealing to people.
Well, you know, we people are under government. So much economic pressure. Yeah. Of course they're making those decisions.
We need a government that says, actually, the best interest for you, for your community, for our economy, is not to do that. What we're going to do instead is we're going to give you support to get through this period of time. We're going to give you support to make sure you can buy your own home once the crisis passes, once we're able to make sure you've got a secure job.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I think the promise that would give a lot of, give Australians a lot of hope, and specifically economic hope, would be the government committing to directly creating some jobs. You know, once upon a time in this country, we had government investment in enterprises that employed people. We built the Snowy Mountain Hydro Scheme in order to employ people and improve our infrastructure and our energy efficiency as well. It's not like there aren't things that Australia could be doing. We could be investing in renewable power or decentralised renewable power all over the country. We could be improving roads. We could be looking at better forestry management and protection. We could be doing all of those things where the government says to Australians, there will be jobs for you at the end of this crisis and we will be paying for them.
It's really interesting that when the government, for a very brief period of time, right at the start of the crisis, did provide free childcare for everyone, inflation and the cost of living dropped to negative. Hmm. You know, so there was a way the government was able to, in a really affordable, really targeted way, bring down household cost of living. At the same time, that's jobs. That's jobs in childcare. That's jobs in early education. That's jobs. If you commit some money to making improvements in those areas, you can even have those blue collar jobs that Scott Morrison seems so desperate to think to promote to people that he's delivering, which he's not.
No, he's not.
So that brings us, I think, to a really good stage where we need to bring in our man in Canberra and see what is going on up there, because it looks from a distance like it's all over the place.
Andrew Giles, are you there?
Well, look, Ben, firstly, it's great to be chatting with you and Ben. I'm really excited to be doing this and sharing some thoughts with you and your listeners. There is a lot happening in federal parliament at the moment. People will probably be aware that the Prime Minister hasn't been very keen on the parliament meeting and his actions being subject to scrutiny. So it was nearly 70 days had passed between the last sittings and now. There are a few really critical issues that are working their way through the parliament at the moment. For most Australians, issues around support to keep people in work are fundamental. So we'll be dealing today with extending the JobKeeper regime, the wage subsidy approach that obviously Labor called for from the very start and we dragged the government kicking and screaming towards. It's obviously critically important that we enable people to still maintain their connection to employment through this period. And also, we'll be pressing to see that the rate of JobSeeker, the current Newstart arrangement, remains at an appropriate level for people to be able to support themselves and dignity into the future. The other really critical question for me especially goes to aged care at the moment. And I think every Australian has been horrified at what we have seen happen in aged care facilities in New South Wales first and more recently in Melbourne. And it's been said often but rightly that this pandemic has been a device which has revealed the cracks that have existed in our society, and we've seen how inequalities have been exposed in so many areas. But the way in which the private aged care sector has operated has been absolutely shocking. In my electorate at the Epping Gardens facility, we've seen more than 200 people, residents and workers, test positive to coronavirus. 28 people have died. And this is one example of many. And what we have seen from the federal government is quite extraordinary. We've seen, firstly, this litany of failures from the Sydney cases in Dorothy Henderson Lodge and in Newmarch to all these issues in Victoria, and the Prime Minister and a minister who just won't take responsibility. They won't say sorry. They won't accept responsibility, and they won't take action. So these issues with aged care are critically important. Probably another thing that may not be on people's minds but should be is we understand that the government's going to introduce some legislation to reshape our national environment laws. And in Labor, we're very concerned about this. We know that there have been resources industry interests that have been keen to strip away the protection of our national environmentally significant issues and to devolve powers to the states without adequate safeguards. So that's an issue that I think is an emerging one that should be of concern to all Australians.
And there are already lots of loopholes that can enable environmental exploitation. The idea that the Liberals want to make those laws even weaker is something of a concern.
Look, it's a huge concern. And my colleague and our friend Terry Butler will obviously be leading the charge for Labor in this regard. I think everyone accepts that the EPBC Act, the Commonwealth law introduced by John Howard, isn't fit for purpose and is ripe for review. But that can't mean the lowest common denominator. It's a national approach to safeguarding the natural environment that enabled us, amongst so many other things, to save the Franklin. About icons of modern Australian decision making, it's hard to be more fundamental than that. So, this is such a critical fight that looks like it's coming before us. And we know ever since Tony Abbott won the 2013 election, the hard right of the Liberal Party and certain business interests have been determined to rip apart the safeguards that do exist in our national environment laws. We've seen not only this in a legislative sense, but we've seen a defunding of the functions in the Environment Department that's contributed to so much frustration and delay in this space as well.
And should people be worried that there's a bit of smoke and mirrors here from the Morrison government?
Yeah, look, we have got a number of concerns. I mean, we will be supporting the extension of the JobKeeper regime.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think in this area, this time, it's so important not to let perfect be the enemy of the good. But there are a number of concerns we have in this space that have been articulated by Tony Burke as our shadow minister, by Albo, of course, and by the leaders of the trade union movement. What we've seen from working people and the Labor Party has been a willingness to work with the government. We haven't always seen that reciprocated. And in terms of this legislation, I think everyone understands that there are enormous complexities in managing a regime like this and ensuring that some appropriate flexibilities about changed work patterns are enabled, but there are appropriate safeguards there. And that's the challenge that we are up for in the Parliament when that debate begins today. And look, as of whatever time it is this morning, it's not entirely clear to me our pathway through to amendments, but let's be really clear. We certainly are open to moving amendments if amendments are required in the House and in the Senate.
I know that can be really hard work when you don't have control of the agenda and the government has numbers to kind of almost do what it wants, but obviously you're holding them to account, so it's really good to see.
Ben, I think there's a really big issue that underpins everything that Anthony Albanese has been trying to do through this period, which is a very different time than any of us have experienced in our lifetime. Yeah. I think Australians want to see anyone in a leadership position, but particularly those of us in the National Parliament, doing all we can to work together through this crisis. So there's an expectation on us to be more constructive than I think would be ordinarily the case in politics, which is a challenge for all of us who've got deep-seated beliefs that drive us there. But for us, that is the challenge that we're up for, to meet the expectations of Australians, which is not about shortchanging any beliefs, but making sure that we can do all we can to get people through this crisis. And that largely, because unfortunately we are in opposition, involves pushing the government. And I think our record shows that we have broadly been successful at winning the arguments, even when we're not in a position to win the votes, such as getting a wage subsidy up and running. Our next big case is obviously about forcing the government to actually put in place a plan for jobs. At the moment, we don't have a plan for a recovery, let alone the sort of recovery that Labor believes Australians are entitled to, which is a recovery that leaves no one behind and holds no one back.
So there is, of course, no sign of a jobs plan from the government still.
No. And when they've talked about initiatives in the space of jobs, it really shows the Prime Minister, frankly, at his worst. He's always up for a slogan, but not up for the policy that that follows the slogan. And of course, it should be the other way around. And I think we see that most obviously with the disastrous home builder program.
Yeah.
And I guess the other point beyond the failures of these particular initiatives to meet the needs that they purport to serve is a failure to recognise that this recession is different from previous recessions in that the economic impact has disproportionately fell on working women. And that is something that is just not being acknowledged by this government. And it's something that we have been concerned about for some time. And if you look at the downstream impact of some of the job losses, the service sector in particular, and the caring economy are areas which are disproportionately affected. But these are not things the government seems interested in talking about, much less doing something about.
And you almost get a sense that if Morrison acknowledges that these industries are the ones most affected, then he's going to have to actually look under the hood and realise that the driving problem here is this job insecurity, and it is massively impacting younger people, women, new migrants to Australia in a much more disproportionate way, and he's just not prepared to do that.
No, well, it just seems to me that he's still in the frame, as so many neoliberals are, that there is no public policy problem that can't be solved by lowering company tax rates and delivering further flexibilities to the labour market.
As we say in this household, Scott Morrison never met a buck he couldn't pass.
Well, that is exactly right. I said yesterday in the Parliament, you know, the buck always stops with somebody else when it's Scott Morrison. And that's so antithetical to where I think Australians' expectations of political leadership are. And I think those of us who live in Victoria see the counterpoint in Daniel Andrews every day, who fronts and has made clear from the get-go that the decisions taken by the government that he leads are decisions that he is responsible for. I think that is why the Victorian people recognise his strength as a leader through difficult times. I think Australians are entitled to so much more. And on this specific question, Ben, about the role of insecure work in exacerbating the consequences of the pandemic, I just think it's absolutely fundamental that our national parliament addresses this. We talked earlier about the government's press for flexibilities in industrial relations arrangements in the consequence of JobKeeper. Well, again, there have been cases accepted by the union movement by us where this is an appropriate response to particular circumstances. But equally, it should be within the grasp of the government and conservatives more broadly to understand the other side of this equation, that we have seen so many tragedies visited upon our community and on individuals because of a system of work that is fundamentally broken. Thanks, Ben. And look, thanks, Ben. It's an absolute pleasure to be chatting with you. And it's, I guess, times like this where we see politics as being more important than ever. We've got a huge opportunity because I think now, for the first time in decades, we are seeing a greater level of trust in political institutions. And from those of us who want to see this parliament deliver progressive change, this is a moment that has to be seized, not just to get through this time of crisis and to hold Australians together, but to build a better and stronger and more resilient social compact as we emerge. And I'm very excited to have the privilege to be part of that challenge.
On that upbeat note, it's probably a good time for us to have a look at our positive story of the week. Van, what have you got for us?
You're going to love this. So remember how in the federal election campaign, Scott Morrison laid into Bill Shorten and his plan to build an electric car industry in Australia. So Shorten was like, electric vehicles, way of the future. And Morrison was like, no, I'm such a bloke, I want a bit of grant. You know, nobody believed him, but we went along with it anyway. Well, as it turns out, with absolutely no federal government encouragement or support in the time since the federal election and those particularly disparaging remarks about electric vehicle sales in Australia have tripled. They've tripled. So the market is growing for electric vehicles, which is particularly interesting because one of the main reasons that people don't buy electric vehicles is because of the price. Because at the moment, you can't get an electric vehicle in this country for under $65,000, which means that people with that money are buying them.
Yep.
But even better news, there are 28 makes of electric vehicles on the market at the moment. Another two are coming out next year that will be priced beneath $50,000. And with the kind of investment that's being put into electric vehicle charging stations, you have one of the longest tracks of electric vehicle highway in the world having been built by the Queensland government. Well, that's where the future is. The market is turning and Scott Morrison was wrong.
Well, that's good news. The good news is not only that Scott Morrison is wrong, but that electric vehicles are taking off, and in a stagnant economic environment, there will be lower cost electric vehicles for ordinary working people and all the infrastructure that we need because of state Labor governments. Folks, this has been The Week on Wednesday. We have gone a little bit longer than we did last time. Thank you very much to our very special guest, Andrew Giles. I don't think Germanicus has made quite as much of an impact on this episode as he did the first.
Because he's asleep on my lap.
Hopefully he'll join us for more in episode 3. Stay tuned though. On Sunday, we hope to do a very special Sunday edition of The Week on Wednesday where we'll have a look at the convention season in the United States. This is something where Van is very much a topic expert. I'm coming new to it, but there's lots of things there to discuss. Some of it quite crazy, some of it quite inspirational. As always, if you have any questions, do send us an email to theweekonwednesday@gmail.com. Check us out on Facebook and on Twitter. And we will see you on Sunday, if not next week.
Yes, I'm very excited. Can I just say, Benny, I love you.
Love you too, Vanny. Bye.